WFAE Podcasting is funded by Corporate Information Technologies, helping businesses take a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After a storm delay, the Republican National Convention kicked off last night in Tampa. Although not the newsmakers they used to be, these big political get-togethers do provide a way to galvanize the faithful and to tell the party's story. And this political year, both parties have a very different story to tell. Parts of the story will be crafted for the media show in prime time by key speakers, various videos, the convention backdrop itself, and, of course, the candidate speeches. But much of the vision for America that these two parties want to share has already been handled by their respective platforms. Both the Democratic and Republican platforms have been crafted to appeal to each party's base, but despite the presence of a plank in the Democratic platform that sanctions same-sex unions, the GOP platform seems to be getting the most attention. Some have described it as severe. But that categorization would only be accurate for those who oppose the various planks. So this hour, on this second day of the RNC, we take a closer look at the GOP platform, the candidates' relationship to it, and how it is likely to play outside of the convention hall in Tampa. We're joined by Dr. Scott Huffman, an associate professor of political science and founder and director of the Social Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop University. Welcome back. And Dr. Eric Heberlig is an associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. He will also be our resident political scientist every weekday of this program next week. Didn't say that very elegantly, as we devoted the show to the coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Welcome back to you.
Thanks.
And Jim Morrill joins us by cell phone from his room in Tampa, where he's covering politics and the convention, the RNC, for the Charlotte Observer. Jim Morrill, thank you for joining us as well.
Glad to be here, Mike.
Now, before we talk about platform and other issues, let's talk about the opening night of the convention. I watched three different networks' coverage of this as going back and forth last night, as I'm wont to do, and many of them had many different things to say about the speakers and about how last night was a kickoff night and what an impact it may or may not have had on the delegates. And what I came away with was this is a party in not disarray, but they didn't do what they needed to do last night. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I think they did a lot of what they needed to do, which was sort of, you know, get the ball rolling. I think they were put off because they had to change the opening night. They had to move it a night, and there was a little bit of confusion about who would get to speak, who would be formally bumped, who's going to be moved where. They wanted to fire up the faithful. The thing they needed to do officially was, you know, tally the count so that Mitt Romney became the official nominee. The disarray really happened, if you were paying attention earlier in the day, to the floor fights where the Ron Paul folks were really trying to stir things up and get some rules changes. So to the degree that it looked like disarray, it was, I think, because of some obscure rules fights. Other than that, they were trying to fire up the faithful.
Well, yes, and that's what I'm talking about. When all the anchors that I was watching, the pundits that I was watching, were saying that, that Chris Christie gave a barn burner speech, but he hardly mentioned Mitt Romney.
I think for most people, if they were tuning in, they were tuning in during prime time. And there, I think the Republican messengers got out the message they want. But, yeah, I noticed that, too, about Christie's speech, that it was a great speech, but not for any particular Republican nominee.
And if you only watched in the 10 o'clock hour, that you saw Ann Romney, Mitt Romney's wife, talk, and she gave, a pretty good speech, actually, about her life with him and his approach to life itself. And she wanted to talk about love, and she embraced women around the country because they're out to try to get women because they know the Democrats are way ahead with women, with the women's vote. But then Chris Christie comes on and says it's not about love, it's about respect. So Jim Morrill, I mean, is that do they have their wires crossed? Did somebody not read both speeches and say, no, you can't say these diametrically opposed things?
it was a little jarring when he first said that, but I'll tell you what, I thought Christie almost gave a better speech to the North Carolina delegation the morning before that. He's going around speaking to delegations just like a lot of people like him are, a lot of BFPs. Marco Rubio's talking to them this morning. But when he spoke to the North Carolina delegates, he talked about Mitt Romney, the man, sort of Mitt Romney, the character of Mitt Romney that he had gotten to know. And so on that, in that sense, it was more personal. Mitt Romney, the father and the grandfather. And you're right, a lot of that was missing from last night, which was more of a, you know, go get them kind of speech, but less by the candidate.
I forgot which person said this, and you know, you don't necessarily know. Since I don't know which network said this, somebody said that a lot of this appeal to the generation that came here, that were immigrants that came here and built themselves up from nothing. They came with a dollar in their pocket and went on to build lives and families and contribute to the community and become the first person in their families to go through college, etc. That's not the generation they need to talk to, because that's a generation of long, long ago, that this new generation, the one that's just come through this recession, doesn't really relate to that. Is that true, you think?
Well, I think they need to shore up their bases everywhere. And they had a lot of people, you know, Martinez and Cruz. And I frankly think Cruz's speech was better than Christie's. I think in a few years we won't be looking back and saying Christie's was the Obama 04 speech for him. I think, you know, we'll be talking a little more about Cruz's speech. But, you know, what they're trying to do is change the narrative about the Republican Party with that, reaching out to those folks by saying we are inclusive, we do reach out to immigrants, we are not just the rich white guy party. We're trying to put a face out there that we reach out to women, we reach out to minorities, we reach out to immigrants. So I think it's part of the attempt to change the narrative, not necessarily to capture one base over another.
Without having to compromise on their policy proposals, right, which are aggressively anti-immigrant.
Which we'll talk about. Jim, I don't know where you were for these speeches last night, and I've covered a convention before, so I know that you actually can see much more and see it better on television than you can if you're on the convention floor. But where were you, and what was the reaction of either the North Carolina delegation or the delegates that you were able to hang around and listen to? What was their reaction to last night?
Well, you're right, Mike. I wasn't on the floor. I was in the workspace at the convention center, which is, you know, about a block away from the St. Pete Times Forum, Tampa Bay Times Forum. But, you know, the reaction looked, you know, when they flashed the crowd, as I'm sure you saw, they looked pretty jubilant by the end of the night. I think they were ready to get fired up. They were looking for an excuse to get fired up. You know, what Dr. Hoffman said is right. You know, they marched out a whole lot of speakers who were women, you know, even some African-Americans and Hispanics. You know, the African-American congressional candidate from Utah, of all places, you know, was impressive. You know, so I think they are trying to show a different face to their party.
South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley spoke in the 9 o'clock hour. Why Nikki Haley? Of all the governors that they could have chosen, why her?
10:05, I think, is around when she came on. Okay. There are a couple of reasons. One, she endorsed Mitt Romney early. And she, you know, so she came out for him early. So there's a little bit of a reward thing going on. But she is also nationally seen very differently than she's seen in South Carolina. In South Carolina, she has people who absolutely adore her, but she has people who are huge detractors even within her own party. So she's a lightning rod in South Carolina. But outside South Carolina, she has a very different image. She's, you know, youngest governor in South Carolina's history, female governor, minority governor, you know, all firsts in South Carolina. She's seen as a tough, aggressive, you know, go-getter, willing to stand up for conservative ideals outside of, you know, South Carolina. She's got this beautiful, you know, a narrative life story, which conservatives are picking up on. So she's really seen as a standard bearer. And as, you know, Jim pointed out, yet another way to reach out to women, to minorities, to show a new face. And she did her job pretty well. She gave a good speech. She railed against Obama and all the right things. She supported Mitt Romney in all the right ways. She did pretty good for herself. She is seen outside of South Carolina as an up-and-coming star in the conservative movement, and I think that's why she got a prime spot combined with her early support for Mitt Romney.
For those people who only watch this on television, if in fact anybody watches it on television anymore, things don't just happen at night, and things don't just happen between 10 and 11 o'clock at night. They happen all day. So what kinds of things was the North Carolina delegation involved in yesterday, Jim Morrill, through the day, and what kinds of things will they be involved in today through the day?
Well, I think that the day didn't start for them until they had a breakfast where they had Herman Cain speak yesterday, and then they kind of chilled until about noon when the buses began to leave for the convention venues. But there was a little drama. We woke up yesterday morning and under our door was a piece of paper from the Ron Paul people regarding some rule changes. What has been referred to as some obscure rule changes involving a future selection of delegates. And so that didn't get resolved until they got to the floor. But just getting down to the venue, I think took some time for people. And then, most of them were getting their first look at the Tampa Bay Times Forum where the convention was held. So, the program, I think, started at 2 o'clock or around there. So,
but I mean, what are they for people who don't know? What are they doing in that convention hall from 2 o'clock until 11 o'clock at night? What's going on? Because television starts looking at it maybe unless you're watching C-SPAN or some of these live feeds on the internet and places like that. Television coverage begins around 7 o'clock. So, what goes on all day?
A lot of times they're just milling around. There's groups of people have meetings with each other. There's a lot of receptions. There's food, pretty readily available. The networks are bringing networks in their booths up in the broadcast area of the convention hall, are bringing people up there to talk. A lot of people are milling around. If you see a parade of speakers going to the podium, like Tampa Bay Mayor Buckhorn yesterday welcomed the delegates. But when the cameras panned around during his 2-minute speech, you see just a lot of people mingling and moving around. Very few people actually in their chairs.
How rewarding for the speakers. Tonight, some heavy hitters. Senator Rand Paul, who is Ron Paul's son, will speak at some point tonight. Senator John McCain speaks tonight. Condoleezza Rice speaks tonight. And, of course, Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee, speaks tonight. Aside from Paul Ryan, obviously, who gets the 10 o'clock hour? Does anybody know?
I don't know who they've given. When is the... Is it Thursday they're doing the mystery speaker? What night is they?
Well, I don't know. I didn't know there was a mystery speaker.
One night they were doing. I'm not sure what the lineup is.
Thursday is Jeb Bush, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and of course Mitt Romney, among others. I mean, there'll be other speakers, but out of those, who do you put on at 10 o'clock? Aside from Mitt Romney, do you put Marco Rubio, who's an up and comer, or do you put Jeb Bush, who's waiting in the wings?
I think you put Rubio. I think he's introducing Romney. And Marco Rubio is very popular among Florida Republicans, and he's actually speaking to the North Carolina delegates as we speak. But he's very popular, and so he'll get a good primetime slot.
Yeah, as popular as Jeb Bush is with the Republican base, I don't think you want somebody with the last name Bush coming right before Romney to the general public who aren't dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, because you don't want that association in their mind.
In terms of a keynote speech that was given last night by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who is a different kind of speaker and a very good speaker, actually. He has passion, and you get the feeling that he believes everything he's saying. But did he set the tone for the convention with that speech last night?
Yeah, I think he hit a number of themes that they wanted to hit, emphasizing leadership, contrasting his leadership in New Jersey with the lack of leadership they're going to argue that Obama has. The second American century part of the speech I thought was very effective. Republicans believe that Obama advocates an American decline. So that American exceptionalism argument, I think, is an important theme that they're going to emphasize. Getting results, he emphasized. That's a theme that they're going to hit on over and over. So he set up a lot of things.
We have to stop. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community School of the Arts, teaching music lessons and art classes at more than a dozen studios across Charlotte. Now registering for fall classes and private lessons. Details online at csarts.org. North Carolina has long been a battleground state, and not just in the political arena, but with labor as well. Labor unions, which improve the lives and wages of workers in other parts of the country, have been successfully kept at bay here in this right-to-work state. Something not lost on those traditional supporters of the Democratic Party. And as we approach the convention and Labor Day itself, we look at the labor issues that are likely to be discussed at both conventions tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, update from the Republican convention. Mitt Romney becomes the official GOP presidential nominee, the speeches begin, and fierce weather bears down on the Gulf Coast.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Republican National Convention. We're going to talk about the Republican platform, in a moment or two here with Jim Morrill, who's with the Charlotte Observer. He is in Tampa covering the convention for the paper. Dr. Scott Huffman is Associate Professor of Political Science at Winthrop University, and Dr. Eric Heberlig is an Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, and our resident political scientist during this program every day next week during the DNC. I had to interrupt you because of the break. We were talking about the keynote speech last night by Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey, and you were going through some of the points that he was making and some of the things that he was trying to do with that speech.
Yeah, I think it was a Christie speech in that there are things that he's really known for, the blunt talking, mm-hmm. even to the point of rudeness, taking on the tough policy task. So you saw that element out of it, and he was able to draw that as a contrast between himself and his critique of the current leadership in Washington.
Someone last night, and it may have been Chris Christie, I don't know, mentioned support for the military and making sure that we have a strong military. Is that to say that we don't have one now?
That's standard Republican speech. I mean, regardless of how aggressive the Democrats have been on the military, we're always going to hear that from the Republicans.
And yet, it's part
of the Americana flag rate.
And yet, no one that I saw last night mentioned the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq.
Well, there have been some interesting developments. You know, when Ryan spoke in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home of Fort Bragg, he actually said he liked the 2014 drawdown for Afghanistan, which, you know, there has been a lot of criticism of Obama over that. And, of course, the 12 drawdown of the surge troops, there is continued criticism over that. I think the talk of sequestration, the automatic cuts that are going to hit the Department of Defense, and other talks about cutting money to Department of Defense from the Obama administration is just providing fodder for what Eric said is absolutely typical. Don't cut the military. The Republican Party is always seen as very pro-military. I think that's just red meat for the faithful.
Bloomberg says that party platforms are generally ignored by the media, even the discussions of them at the conventions, because they generally treat everything that happens as nothing more than a show. But Bloomberg also says that this year the tussle over the unloved, often ignored party platform may be one of the few genuine things that happens all week. Will there be, has there been a tussle over the party platform? Do we know? Jim Morrill?
I don't think so. You know, there's been some talk about it because, especially after the Missouri episode with Senate candidate Todd Akin talking about abortion and legitimate rape, when the Republicans put a plank in their platform opposing all abortion, that got some attention. But because it didn't call for any exceptions for rape or incest. But it's the same plank that they've had for two other conventions running. And they say that, you know, they're going to leave it up to the states to put any exceptions in or whatever. But this is their plank, and they're sticking to it. But I don't think there'll be a fight over it.
Well, yeah, I don't think there's going to be any fight over it. Although I don't think would it even have come to our attention. Would anybody have paid any attention to this particular plank? Because, as you say, it has been in the last two party platforms. Had it not been for Missouri Representative Todd Akin's comment, would anybody had even would a flag even have gone up?
I don't think so. Not in the the general media, because everybody would have just simply expected that. That is more of a way to say to the faithful, to the very, very pro-life segment of the Republican Party, you know, we are adhering to your beliefs. Make sure you turn out and vote for us because we're the party that, you know, that has your beliefs enshrined in our platform. And they do that. That's the main point of the platform, is to enshrine the beliefs of key constituencies. And no, it wouldn't have risen to, I think, media coverage otherwise, because it was really, you know, it would be expected.
I think it would have gotten some attention from the Obama campaign. They'd have pointed it out. They'd have made it part of the Republican War on Women narrative. But it certainly wouldn't have gotten the broader attention that it got from the media had Akin not spoken out.
I want to get, before we talk more about the platform, I want to get back to one thing I heard last night. I have to understand that when you watch MSNBC, you know that you're watching the opposing political party going after the Republicans. And the same thing if you watch Fox during the Democratic National Convention, you will see what MSNBC probably is doing to the Republican situation. But after who spoke last night? Help me out here. Pennsylvania.
Rick Santorum.
Thank you. After Rick Santorum speak, Andrea Mitchell asked him a question about something he said in the speech about welfare to work. He made the allegation again that's been made in television commercials that President Obama has stripped the welfare to work provision out of the welfare program, and therefore you don't need to work anymore, thanks to the president. And they had earlier in the night debunked that. They had gone to fact checkers, et cetera. And he didn't answer the question. She asked him specifically, you know that's not true. Why did you say it? And he didn't answer the question. Evidently, there's a lot of this going back and forth in both parties where fact checkers go and they check the facts, and what's being said is demonstrably not true. And yet they continue to say it. And somebody last night at the Republican convention said, we are not going to be confused by fact checkers. I mean, what are we to make of this? I don't think I've seen anything like this before, where things are being said that have been proven to be false, but they continue to be said as though they were true, and the facts are being ignored.
I think the fact checking is going more quickly. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to say, I don't know that the facts are being ignored, but I think people have a perception of fact checkers as part of the other side.
But wait, you're a reporter. Aren't facts facts?
I think they are, but I think a lot of people don't. I think people color their interpretation of facts based on who's doing the fact checking.
But is this part and parcel of the fact that people don't believe science anymore? Because, you know, science is a fact that we don't choose to believe. I mean, what does that say about us? That we just don't choose to believe things that we don't believe?
I don't think that that's anything new. I just think it's being thrown up in our face because fact-checking has become part of the 24-hour news cycle. You can, you know, Google anything at a millisecond's notice on your phone as somebody is speaking.
Right.
And so the fact-checking becomes not part of the follow-up next day story, but part of the live story that's happening right there. I think that's the only thing that has really changed, and it's become more frequent. We have more fact-checkers, and that led to people saying, well, these are the fact-checkers from this liberal newspaper, so I don't believe it. But what has always happened, human beings tend to look for evidence that confirms their beliefs. We have always been like that. Partisans are very much like that. And so when something comes along that confirms something you absolutely know in your heart to be true, and then somebody else comes up and says, hey, that fact is incorrect, you know they're wrong because it confirmed what you believed. Everybody's mind is resistant in that way. How far fact checkers can go to tearing down that wall, that's, I think, the question that remains to be seen.
Let's get back to the platform. The GOP platform committee member, Russ Walker, calls this the most conservative platform in modern history, given that we know, I think, if you trust the fact checkers... that much of the electorate is moving to become at least more socially moderate than they were 10 years ago. Is this wise to have the most conservative platform in modern history?
Well, it's wise in that it represents the views of the activists in the Republican Party.
But are they shutting the doors to the party to a lot of people by doing this, as opposed to opening them and welcoming newcomers in?
They know that swing voters don't pay very close attention. They know that if they win, they can claim a mandate for any policies that are in the platform, regardless of whether people were voting on them. As true believers in the policies that they're advocating, their view is that they need to implement these policies regardless of whether other people agree with them. So the task is to win power, to implement these policies, and everybody will be better off if these things pass, regardless of whether there's even a majority of support for them.
The abortion plank is making its appearance on the Republican platform for the third time, the third election cycle. But this time they've called for a constitutional amendment. Is this the first time they've done that, or has this been in the other planks in the platform?
Well, I don't know about the platforms because I don't recall the specific language of the previous platforms, but this has been part of the growing narrative of an amendment for life, and talk about trying to make, life being defined as at the moment of conception and constitutional amendments in that direction. I don't know if it's been an actual constitutional amendment suggestion in the previous planks of platforms or not.
What's the process?
Mike, can I just say something? Don't forget that this is a platform that people are going to stop talking about in a day or two if they haven't already. But because when the platform came out with the strong abortion language, Reince Priebus, the Republican National Chairman, made a point to say that this is the Republican Party platform. It's not necessarily Mitt Romney's platform. And Romney himself has advocated exceptions in the abortion situation, for example, exceptions for rape and incest. So he's already on record as not going, hand in glove with the platform.
And the life of the mother.
Well, and I know this. The Democrats are equally guilty of this as well. This is how it works. I understand this. But why have a platform if the candidates aren't bound by the platform? If the platform represents the views of the party, be they Democratic views or Republican views, and the standard bearer has different views that he's going to implement, he or she is going to implement, if they get to the White House, what's the point of the platform? Who speaks for the party? Does the platform speak for the party, or does the candidate speak for the party? And if you don't have agreement between the platform and the candidate, why is the candidate the candidate?
Well, they both speak for the party, and the party is many candidates. It's the presidential candidates, the governor candidates, it's the congressional candidates, and they're all going to adapt the platform to the local voters that they face. But for the average voter, what they see as the party message is that's articulated by the presidential candidate.
And remember, the platforms are put together by the most faithful, by the most vehement, by the strongest partisans. So it represents a level of ideological purity, within the party. But the average person who simply identifies with the party, who is not a super activist, who will never be at a committee meeting, planning out the platform, the average rank and file voter is always a little more moderate, and the candidate has to dance a dance between those two, the rank and file voter and the purist. And so you're never going to see, I think, pure adherence by a candidate to a party platform.
Jim Morrill, have you heard anybody talking about the platform at all down there?
No. I talked to somebody before we got down here. The platform committee met last week, and a woman from Charlotte, Mary Suma, who's been on the platform committee for the party for I think four times now, she had a big role in it, and the whole question of life is very important to her, and she's the one who introduced another plank about RU486, what people call the abortion pill or morning after pill, and so but beyond since last week, you just don't hear too much talk about it at all.
This year's platform in the Republican Party will drop language, I'm told, saying that the once sacred home mortgage interest tax deduction must be protected. They're going to drop language that says that. In 2008, the GOP platform said because affordable housing is in the national interest, any simplified tax system should continue to encourage home ownership, recognizing the tremendous social value that the home mortgage interest deduction has had for decades. And Bloomberg News says that they took this language out this year to give Mitt Romney more flexibility to promote his plan to lower taxes or lower tax rates paid by corporations and the wealthiest Americans without increasing the federal debt. How big a shift is that? If they were successful in removing the home mortgage interest tax deduction, how big a shift would that be? How would that be received in the heartland, where part of the American dream is to own a home? And one of the things that helps you do that, theoretically speaking, is the home interest mortgage deduction.
Yeah, I think one thing that both candidates have gotten criticized from talking head pundits is their lack of acceptance of the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction plan. And one reason they didn't is because it suggested going after tax deductions that everybody enjoys, like the home mortgage deduction. Mm-hmm. So for the Republicans to signal that they're willing to sacrifice that for tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans is a significant shift and a significant signal of their priorities.
It is wildly popular. I mean, you're right. When people are made aware of it, and I don't think, you know, most folks are reading the platform, just like Jim said, most folks even down there aren't talking about the platform. But when people become aware of that, that is a very popular deduction. And, it, you know, the truth is we've always been defining for the past 20, maybe even 30 years that the American dream included home ownership. And that, you know, everybody wanting to get a home, even if it took a risky mortgage to get into it, actually contributed probably to the economic collapse when, you know, some of these folks, many people should have been renting for longer. And so it's very controversial. It's very complex, but it is very, very popular. And direct talk about cutting it, you know, as Eric said, that is one of several things that killed Simpson-Bowles.
Direct talk about cutting it while you're also talking about lowering taxes paid by corporations and the wealthiest Americans. How will that play? Why would you put that in your platform? I mean, going through tough economic times. People are hurting. Why would you want to hurt them more?
Yeah, the platform, I'm sure, does not make that direct connection. It says we're dropping our support.
And also the GOP is the party of business. If you drop the home and mortgage interest deduction, it seems to me, and realtors will tell you this could hurt new home builders. This could hurt the realty business because that could be the difference between being able to buy a house and not being able to buy a house.
Yeah,
that's the part business sector.
That's the part that surprises me about the Republicans dropping it. That the real estate industry are major players within the Republican Party. That the Republicans would drop that presumably over the objections of their real estate constituents is pretty shocking.
I would imagine the real estate political action committees are probably banking on the fact that they can, with their lobbyists, push in Congress enough members to halt this. And, that's why I think there's not a blazing, rush by realtors about this. They probably feel that even if it's taken out, that doesn't mean anything until it comes up for a vote, and they will be at the ready.
They've also said no tax increases. If you remove the home interest mortgage deduction, the home mortgage interest deduction, mm-hmm. isn't that a tax increase?
By another name, yes.
Yeah.
Some of this is all, Mike, in the context of the talk in general about tax reform. I mean, there's a lot of sentiment among Republicans in particular, and Democrats too, but about tax reform. And there's a lot of Republicans who believe in something called the fair tax, which would eliminate all exemptions like that and replace it with a national sales tax. Which they claim would be more fair. That's why they call it the fair tax. And so some of this is in the context of all these other efforts and conversations about reforming the overall tax code.
Jim Morrill is covering the convention in Tampa for the Charlotte Observer. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Johnston, Allison, and Horde for more than a century, serving clients in a competitive landscape, believing that good counsel is more than sound legal advice. Johnston, Allison, and Horde at jahlaw.com. And Bylow Supermarket, serving the Southeast for over 50 years, featuring Gold Star Meats, Walter's Fresh Produce, and the Bylow Bonus Card. Store locator and fuel perks program. Details at buy-low.com. Mitt Romney becomes the official GOP presidential nominee, and the speeches begin. You can join Diane Rehm and her guests to talk about the latest developments at the Republican National Convention after we finish talking about them here this morning. She comes up in 20 minutes. You can join us now, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Judy Kaufman, president of Media Power Advertising in Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
You go to a music station and the audience is not listening. At WFAE, they're active listeners, so they're hearing your message much more than they would on another radio station. If you want an active listener and you want to brand a message, WFAE is the place to be.
For more information, email underwriting at wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the GOP convention and the party platform in Tampa. Jim Morrill is in Tampa, joining us by cell phone. He's reporting on it for the Charlotte Observer. Dr. Scott Huffman is associate professor of political science at Winthrop University, and Dr. Eric Heberleg, our go-to guy next week here at the Democratic National Convention. He'll be here every day, is associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. We were talking about the home mortgage interest deduction and the elimination of the call for the elimination of that in the Republican platform. Is this part of what Governor Christie was talking about last night, where it's time for politicians to be honest with Americans that we cannot afford certain things anymore, and not everything we're going to say you're going to like, but you need to hear it. You need to take the medicine. Is this what you're talking about?
I think it is, you know, partially because one of the biggest problems with government is whenever you create a new program, it fills some type of need. And, you know, if you look at Keynesianism, the idea of Keynesianism was always, okay, government can expand, it can, you know, do deficit spending to fix these needs. That was the idea to get us out of the Great Depression. But the idea was always, when the economy is better, the government spending has to scale back down. And so whenever anybody goes to a government program and says, this is a waste, it needs to go, people will mumble, oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea. But those folks being directly cut scream bloody murder and say, if you touch this, I will make it my life mission to get you unelected. And so people take their hands off, and Christie's saying, it's time to stand up and say, we got to cut. I'm sorry this hurts.
Well, it's arguable that we have a fiscal crisis. We all know that we're suffering fiscally here, and we're spending tremendous amounts of money, and some of it was spent to try to get us out of this crisis. You can argue till you're blue in the face whether or not what was tried was successful or not. But it's one thing to be honest about some of the fiscal things that we have to face up to and possibly change. But this platform is also more aggressive in its opposition to women's reproductive rights and to gay rights than any platform in history. And it accuses President Obama and the federal judiciary of an assault on the foundations of our society. Are these things that need to be said when you're also saying things that really need to be said about fiscal responsibility?
I think that platforms give activists a chance to vent as much as anything. You know, and there are a lot of people in the party who feel really strongly about these things. Don't forget that Newt Gingrich, when he was campaigning for president, he called for, like, ending lifetime appointments or something for federal judges, and, you know, reducing the size of federal appeals courts and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff churning out there, and I think the platform, to some extent, gives people a chance to vent and for activists to put out their ideas and get them written down on something.
Eric? Going back to the 1950s and the Warren Court's integration rulings and school prayer rulings, the courts have been a whipping boy for conservative Republicans. So despite the fact that most federal judges are now actually Republicans, it's a safe thing for Republicans to do to beat up on federal judges.
And you know, a lot of the activists who are making sure that these appear, think of the mindset. These are folks who are saying, you know, I feel that, you know, I am backed into a corner. Here we see society becoming more and more tolerant of same-sex marriage, same-sex relationships at all, and here am I, this passionate, you know, believer that that's morally wrong. And so they get more and more vehement as they feel they're backed into a corner. So you mentioned before the idea that on some social issues, the greater American public is becoming more moderate. Well, that moderation of the American public is likely to spur this overreaction among the most passionate, and that may be what we're seeing in some of the planks in this platform.
And is that what Rick Santorum is talking about when he says President Obama is destroying the country?
I think it's part of a larger narrative. Jim?
I think it's part of it, but I mean, I think it's hard to overstate how much the president is disliked by a lot of the people down here who do think he's destroying the country.
In what way? In what way? What do they point to?
Well, you know, just health care is a big thing. You know, I mean, people that still colored a lot of things in this whole dialogue and debate. You know, socialism is a word you hear a lot. From people down here, there are people that just really truly believe that four more years. I was talking to somebody the other day who said, you know, four more years and America will be destroyed. I mean, people feel strongly about that stuff down here.
Okay. In addition to the plank in the platform about abortion, there's an immigration plank in the platform. Now, they know that the Democrats tend to do better with women than the Republican Party has. And it seems to me that there's a rising Latino population in America that has to be taken into account if you want to win elections going forward. But this platform plank encourages more Arizona-style state immigration laws, and they call for the federal government to drop its lawsuits against those laws. How's that going to play?
It's going to play well with a Republican base. I mean,
how's it going to play with Latino voters that they need to attract in the coming years if they want to be elected?
Not so well, but that's a future problem, and they'll deal with that when the time comes. I mean, you talk to any political consultant who works for Republicans, they know that this is a big problem for their party, but their candidates cannot do anything right now because the voters that they talk to want language that's as strong as possible, beating up on immigrants.
Right, and remember the mathematics of the problem. Yes, Hispanics are now a larger minority group than African Americans in the U.S., and looked at the macro level, that seems like a huge electoral problem that is looming. But also remember the mathematics of where those Latinos are. A large number of them are in very safely red states. So, you know, the Latino population in Texas may be very upset by this, but that is not going to mean that it's going to go for Barack Obama. So, you know, you can start slicing up the population state by state when you start talking electoral college politics. It's actually going to be a bigger problem for people running for state legislature and statewide offices, I think, in the shorter run, not a big problem for the presidential level for a longer term.
Ron Paul,
I don't know about that. I just wanted to say, like, in states like Nevada and Colorado, though, the Hispanic votes could make a difference. I mean, if you're talking on the margins there in a close race, that's a pretty sizable voting block.
Yeah, and Colorado could be a tipping point state. So you're right. You're right in a couple of states.
Ron Paul was unsuccessful in an attempt to get support for gay civil unions put into the platform. So they compromised with him, and they let him put a plank in the platform that calls for an annual audit of the Federal Reserve. A concession on the part of Mitt Romney, a tip of the hat, I suppose, to Ron Paul supporters. Why do they want to audit the Fed? What would be accomplished by that?
They want it to cease to exist.
Yeah, I know. But what would be accomplished by auditing it to prove that they are
finding any
crooked?
You know, just a chance to find its flaws and make its flaws well known. It's a first step in getting rid of it, is the desire of the Ron Paul folks.
I don't know if any of you are experts on the Federal Reserve, but if the Fed were to go away tomorrow, what would take its place?
Well, that's the issue. You'd have to have something take its place, and that's what I think the critics of the Federal Reserve and the Ron Paul camp don't understand. So I think that the auditing speaks to those in the conservative side who don't want to get rid of it but want to see the Fed held more accountable. Mm-hmm. This would give them information they need to try to rein in.
Isn't the whole point of the Fed that they—
To be independent, exactly, yes. Of politicians.
Yes.
The point of it is that we don't want economic decisions made by people who have to pander to us in the next election.
Right, but the conspiracy theories always say that the Fed is secretly controlled by, you know, other banking interests. Right. And you know, and of course there's, you know, always anti-Semitic things that go on in that too. So the conspiracy theorists just say it doesn't matter. They're controlled by somebody anyway. By gum, let's audit them.
Let's take a call from Bill in Flat Rock. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Hi, Mike. Enjoy the show. Getting to the mortgage interest deduction, I mean, that's built into the price of a house. If you ended it tomorrow, the prices would come down. The consumer has no net gain. And I don't know why we keep playing this game. It's obvious.
That's the first time, Bill, that I have ever heard that the mortgage interest deduction is figured into the price of the house. Who figures that into the price of the house? I, as a seller, if you take away the mortgage interest deduction, which may net you what? A couple of grand a year, I'm not going to lower my price a couple of grand to accommodate you. Why would I do that?
Because it makes the buyer think they're getting something when they're not really getting anything at all at the end of the day.
Where did you get this information?
Ask any banker. Ask any mortgage expert. They'll tell you.
The seller sets the price of the house.
But the buyer pays it. And the market rules. If we ended the mortgage deduction, prices would come down.
Yeah, I think he's making the argument that the equilibrium of the market would probably bring it down. And I'll take the advice of mortgage experts on that.
That because government is essentially subsidizing your mortgage, you're willing and able to buy a bigger house than you otherwise could afford because you're not paying for it all out of pocket. The government's picking up some through the tax deduction. That's the argument.
Okay. Bill, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. Jonathan on Facebook writes, I am very happy to see that the new Republican Party platform includes support of internet freedom. Republicans are committed to opposing senseless and unconstitutional laws that would abridge the basic rights of individuals using the internet. The platform also officially opposes any international governance of the internet and renews commitments to protect personal files online. Apparently, this is the insistence of Rand Paul and other libertarian-style Republicans, and I believe this to be a very good decision.
A lot of it is going to run afoul of some Republicans who want to, you know, push some more oversight of the internet because of copyright infringement and patent protection from the corporations that donate to them. But anytime you see language about how they, you know, believe that there might be international control of the internet, I think that's going to win over other Republicans. And he's absolutely right. The Ron Paulites and the Rand Paul folks are very strong on the issues of net neutrality, internet freedom, all those things.
Despite all these planks in the platform that we've been talking about this morning, and Democrats have corresponding planks in their platform as well, this election is still going to be about the economy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And how is that being handled so far in the one night of the convention that we've seen? How has that been addressed?
We heard a lot about Romney being a businessman, therefore understanding the economy. We heard a lot from particular Governor Christie about the debt. But really, last night, I think that the focus was on telling those personal stories, the up from the bootstrap story of many of these Republican candidates that allowed them to contrast what they see as the Republican emphasis on freedom, entrepreneurship versus what they were labeling the Obama's attempt to make us all dependent on government.
Yeah, I think the narrative is going to be that Obama has simply been yanking the reins back on the economy with his policies, and his debt is saddling us. And well, it depends on which narrative you buy into.
What policies are they referring to then?
The stimulus, really. It's basic economic policy that when the economy goes in the tank, that the government stimulates it. What they don't tell you is that they would stimulate it too. They would emphasize tax cuts more than the Democrats would. But you know, that doesn't make for an easy soundbite and applause line in the in a convention speech.
If you listen, and Jim's there and he hears it, but if you listen to the narrative that the delegates are talking about when they discuss the economy, that's going to be kind of what you're going to hear from the Republican side in general.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget the theme of last night was "We built it." It was, you know, that's a reference again to.
Yeah, so that's another thing. Let's stop right there for a second. That's another thing. There's even a sign on the wall of the convention hall that says, "We built it." Now, it has, and several speakers last night referred to this, I think, including Ann Romney, to this phrase that we as business people, we as individual Americans, we do these things. We built it on our own. And it has been proven more times than I can count that if you listen to the entire quote from President Obama, he was referring to the infrastructure that allows people to drive their personally owned cars and trucks. Their businesses can deliver things because the government built the highways.
And federally backed loans. And, of course, right. The hall where they were having this convention was built with public funds, too.
Right.
So now, why is this one particular line being perpetrated when it is demonstrably untrue?
I think it speaks to the narrative that Republicans believe about Democrats in general and Obama specifically, that he does not respect entrepreneurship, innovation of individuals, and he wants to give credit for individual innovation, individual entrepreneurship to the government or to other people. I mean, it's a perfect narrative.
Will we hear corresponding mistruths at the Democratic National Convention?
Oh, sure. Both sides take others out of context and use it for all it's worth.
Jim?
And don't forget, this fits into the Mitt Romney narrative, too. I mean, it's like his wife was saying last night in her speech. You know, he started out, she said, with very little. They ate tuna sandwiches on an ironing board, and yet he built this company, Bain, which obviously the Democrat became very successful, and Democrats are all over. But again, it's the spirit of entrepreneurship, and it's really a touchstone. It's become a button for both parties.
That's Jim Morrill, who's covering the Republican convention in Tampa for the Charlotte Observer. He's been covering politics for them for years. Thank you for being with us, Jim. Dr. Scott Huffman, associate professor and founder of political science. Associate Professor of Political Science and founder of the Social Behavior Research Lab at Winthrop University, if I could just get it out, and Dr. Eric Heberlig, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.